KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
You're saying, no, state, there are two kinds of marriages, the full marriage and then the sort of skim milk marriage.
I'm an insurance investigator. My name is Johnny Dollar, and I can pad an expense account with the best of them.
There's delicious Korean food to be had just north of Seattle. I was going to mention Husunmi. It specializes in Korean soft tofu soup.
Our regular guest, Sarah Dickerman, from last week, talking about some great Korean food. What will she recommend this time? Stick around to find out. We also heard Johnny Dollar from the Golden Age of Radio. Our radio retrospective will take us back there. And you heard Ruth Bader Ginsburg talking about the kinds of marriage we have in this country. This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle. I'm Steve Scher. Thanks for being here. This week, the U.S. Supreme Court is hearing arguments. Two cases that could reshape the country's legal opinion on same-sex marriage and broaden the definition of marriage. Yesterday, the justices heard arguments on the Defense of Marriage Act, or DOMA, the 1996 law that forbids federal benefits for married same-sex couples. On Tuesday, the court took up California's Proposition 8 law, where voters banned same-sex marriage. Adam Liptak covers the Supreme Court for the New York Times. Adam Liptak, thanks for talking to us, sir.
Sure.
I appreciate you being here.
It's good to be here.
Well, would you remind us, Edith Windsor, the woman who's challenging DOMA, what was her case?
She was married to another woman who died, and because it was a same-sex marriage, she had to pay $363,000 in estate taxes that an opposite-sex couple would not have to pay because of a 1996 federal law called the Defense of Marriage Act, which says that the federal government, for over 1,000 laws and programs, will only recognize traditional marriages.
You know, in reading the headlines of the questioning that the justices were doing, one could get the idea that the justices were skeptical of the Defense of Marriage Act. But I also, in reading the headlines, people were conjecturing justices could overturn the law. I thought that the consensus was that you did not make assumptions based on the tone of the justices' questions.
You know, the truth is that on this court, at least, the justices, for the most part, are not playing devil's advocates and are not that hard to read. And in the great run of cases, there are exceptions, of course, but in the great run of cases, you walk out of the argument with a pretty good sense of where they are.
How interesting. Don't you find that interesting that it's that clear, or it seems to be that clear?
Well, I mean, they are they're very good lawyers, but they're also committed to points of view on the law. You have a pretty good idea even before they start talking where they are in a case, and you get a much better idea once you hear the questions and the tone of voice and so on.
Compare the tone over the DOMA questioning to the day before on the Prop 8 questioning.
So DOMA is in many ways the easier case for the justices. The only question is, should federal benefits flow to people married in states that allow same-sex marriages? So no decision in DOMA would force a state that does not have same-sex marriage to accept it. And that's a case in which the likely swing vote, Justice Anthony Kennedy, has two things that he's really committed to, both pointing in the direction of striking down DOMA. He's in favor of gay rights. He's in favor of states' rights. And there's a real federalism problem, at least he thinks, in the federal government not following what the state has defined as a marriage. So that's DOMA. That's the easier case. The questioning in the Proposition 8 case, which would require the court, if it were to overturn Proposition 8, to tell California that it must have same-sex marriage, even though voters there rejected it in 2008, is a harder lift for the court. And at its greatest sweep, the case could also result, at least in theory, in a decision that would deliver same-sex marriage to all 50 states. That seemed, from the questioning, to be a little more than the court was prepared to do, and there's some reason to think the court will get rid of the case on a technical ground.
Oh, I was going to ask you, what might the court do if they decided it narrowly? But you think they may just say, "You, what is it, standing? Is that going to be the question or something else?
Standing is the most likely threshold issue on which they could get rid of it, although there are other options. And there's a real significant legal question about whether anyone has standing who's before the court, because California officials who lost declined to appeal the decision against them. And the people who did appeal, proponents of Proposition 8, don't obviously have the kind of injury that would allow them to have legal standing. And they don't obviously represent the interests of the state against whom judgment was entered. So a decision on standing is reasonably likely. I think as a practical matter that would deliver marriage to California nonetheless.
Why is that?
My best guess is that Governor Jerry Brown would say, listen, I understand you've knocked the case out on standing. That takes out the appeals court decision because it was all about appellate standing. But it leaves in place Judge Vaughn Walker's decision requiring that Proposition 8 be struck down and that same-sex marriage start in California. And Jerry Brown can say, listen, there's a district court decision. It's all I got, but I'm going to find it persuasive, and I'm going to instruct county clerks to start issuing marriages. And that would sort of flip the dynamic, but I would think that at least in the short term, you'd have marriage back in California.
The district court ruling found that the Prop 8 couldn't restrict people's basic rights? I don't remember what they were.
He said in quite sweeping terms that Prop 8 was unconstitutional, that this is a distinction that violates equal protection principles, that there's no good reason to treat opposite-sex married people and same-sex couples differently.
How interesting, Adam Liptak. That would be an interesting way to go. The concern that people were expressing was that the court would, like the analysis was, like Roe v. Wade, they would move too far out in front of what the legality of the argument could be and therefore continue the political debate. This would keep that from happening?
I think that's a good way to think about it. There are not a few people who thought that the court got too far out ahead of the country on abortion in Roe v. Wade. And there was definitely a feeling on this court that there's just not enough information yet, with only 9 states allowing same-sex marriage and with a quite brief experience with same-sex marriage on the ground, for the court to take a lead on an issue where 41 states go the other way. You probably recall that when the court finally struck down bans on interracial marriage in 1967, very late in the day, long after Brown v. Board of Education, there were only about 16 states that barred interracial marriage, not 41.
Well, it keeps you in the realm of the legislature being the ones who create the laws and the justices ruling on them rather than activist judges, I put in quotes, creating law.
Yeah, so there's two ways to think about it. One is that this is something the democratic process should chew through, and of course it's moving quickly, and the debate is very active, and young people especially are overwhelmingly in favor of same-sex marriage. So one way of thinking about it is let the democratic process take care of this. Another is to say, what are courts for if not to defend the fundamental rights of disfavored minorities?
If the court turns over DOMA, what effect would that have on states? What legal effect would that have on states that ban same-sex marriage or don't allow same-sex marriage?
It would have zero direct effect on those states. All it would say is that states that allow same-sex marriage, couples there would get federal benefits the way opposite-sex married couples do. So it would be, in a way, a quite limited ruling. That's not to say there wouldn't be language and logic in the case that in future cases would apply to arguments to help strike down bans elsewhere. But the direct effect of a DOMA decision would not cause any state ban to fall.
So in the way you're laying out a scenario, Adam Liptak, it does look like the court, if the court went this way, would still be following its nature and upholding the rights of minorities.
I think an attractive way for the court to go is to have what would look like a very significant case on DOMA, and that would take account of the rights of same-sex couples, but a modest step, and leave for another day the question of whether there's a constitutional right to same-sex marriage in states that choose not to allow it.
Adam Liptak covers the Supreme Court for the New York Times. Well, how is this playing out outside the court? We had folks from all walks of life and all political persuasions in front of the court when these arguments began. You had politicians making statements. What are the defenders of the law at this point saying as after these arguments have been made?
Well, they continue to say that this is something where the court should be cautious, move slowly, that there are good reasons for, after thousands of years of having only one form of marriage, not to extend it to a different form. They also make an argument that not everybody can make complete sense of, that somehow allowing gay and lesbian couples to marry would do harm to the marriages of straight people, that that would cause them to be less likely to engage in what these people say is responsible procreation. The logic of that sometimes is a little bit hard to track.
And what are the supporters, what are you hearing in political circles from supporters at this point?
Well, in political circles, as Chief Justice Roberts said in the argument on DOMA, the political class is falling all over itself to come out in favor of same-sex marriage. And Chief Justice Roberts suggested that was a reason for the court to step aside and let the political process take care of these things. I mean, there's really no question but from public opinion polling and simply from the replacement of older people with younger people as they grow older, that the country is moving in the direction of same-sex marriage. The question for the Supreme Court is, does it stand aside and let that trend progress, or does it get out and show leadership on this question?
When you listen to the comments from Justice Scalia and Roberts and no comments from Justice Thomas,
right.
What's their mood? What's their sense? I know this is tea leaves, but mm-hmm. have a sense of it?
Well, it seems reasonably clear two things. One, they're not in favor of finding a constitutional right to same-sex marriage. Two, there may be a divergence between Scalia and Roberts on this. It's not clear to me that Roberts necessarily wants to issue a decision one way or the other. If he has to issue a decision, it will be against same-sex marriage, but he might well like to sidestep one and maybe both cases.
Is this another example of a Roberts courts emerging, depending on, well, I guess even the politics right here, a Roberts court identity emerging?
Well, it is a characteristic Roberts court alignment that you have four conservatives, four liberals, and Justice Kennedy in the middle, meaning that the Roberts court is in some ways the Kennedy court. And Justice Kennedy holds the key vote. And my best reading of what Justice Kennedy means to do is in the broader, bigger case, Prop 8, avoid answering the question, and in the more modest DOMA case, give the answer that the law ought to be struck down.
How long have you been covering the Supreme Court, Adam Liptak?
5 years.
How do you like it?
It is intellectually really interesting. It is not always easy to translate on deadline long, complicated, jargon-filled technical legal decisions into accessible conversational newspaper prose.
And then you have to get on the radio and talk about it. Well, I appreciate you doing it. That's very clear. And when are we going to see a decision? Before June?
The end of June.
The end of June.
24th, June 27th. Those are some good target dates.
All right, sir. Thank you for taking the time.
Good to be here. Take care.
Adam Liptak covers the Supreme Court for the New York Times. You're listening to Weekday on KUOW Seattle. By the way, did anybody, I was up late working on some class project that I'm going to be teaching at the UW, and I was watching Stephen Colbert. If you have a chance to see Stephen Colbert's reaction to the Supreme Court's rulings, and how he talks about how Bill O'Reilly will be marrying a goat, I think you should check that out. This is Weekday.
Ten 18. Leslie Helm is the author of Yokohama Yankee, My Family's Five Generations as Outsiders in Japan. Leslie Helm is here, and he'll tell us his family's story in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Consolidated Press, serving Seattle since 1934, offering full-color web, sheet-fed digital printing, binding, and mailing services. 206-447-9659 or on the web at consolidatedpress.com.
52 degrees in Seattle, mostly cloudy. Chance of showers this afternoon and a high today of 59. Yours truly, Johnny Dollar, was a drama from the golden age of radio that aired all the way into the early 60s. We'll learn more about the show and listen to some clips in 20 minutes.
Now we're going to go from DOMA and those questions of identity, racial, cultural, personal. Leslie Helms' family hails from Yokohama, Japan. Most members of his family, they look like Leslie Helms. Silver hair. I would be hard-pressed to say that you had Japanese ancestors, and yet you do. And you were thinking about that, so Leslie Helm wrote a book about it, Yokohama Yankee, My Family's Five Generations as Outsiders in Japan. He was born and raised in Yokohama. He has worked as the Tokyo correspondent for Business Week and the LA Times. He's now editor of Seattle Business Magazine. It's good to see you.
Thanks for having me.
And Yokohama Yankee, My Family's Five Generations as Outsiders in Japan, printed, published by Chin Music Press of Seattle, guys that came from, in part, from New Orleans. They do beautiful work, and this is a beautiful book. Beautiful pictures, feels good.
Thanks very much. I think you've done a great job with it.
It's always something to think about, right? And then the package itself, one would miss that if one were just looking at it at an iPad, though I bet the iPad version would be great because it'd be also in activity and stuff.
Yeah, I think this is a book that's to be best experienced as in paper.
So on the cover of this book is a picture of a family. Who are the folks on the cover here?
The man in the center with in the school uniform, that's my grandfather.
And what's his name?
Julius. Julie,
you guys called him. Yeah?
Right. And on the far right is my great-grandmother, Hito. And to his right is my great-grandfather, Julius.
How did Julius, the great-grandfather, come to be in Yokohama?
So he left Germany, came to the States like many Germans and hoped to make his fortune farming, but that didn't work out. So he ended up heading further west and planned on taking a ship to China, missed a ship, and ended up in Yokohama.
And that time, Yokohama was in the midst of being the thriving port city, or was it just emerging as a thriving port city?
Right. Japan had been basically isolated for 250 years, and Commodore Perry had come along and forced Japan open. So that had happened just about 10 years before my great-grandfather arrived.
Literally forced it open. And these enclaves that the Europeans had were armed enclaves in the sense, right? They were enclaves they had carved out of the land.
Well, in this case, what they really did was there was a little village that they kicked out all the inhabitants of the village and established a foreign settlement. But it was, surrounded by water on all sides. So,
how come he stayed? Why was he staying there and doing this work for the years he stayed?
Well, initially he worked as a military advisor. At that time, Japan was trying to catch up with the West. They didn't want to be like China, which had been, exploited.
Really carved up.
Carved up, and opium had been imported. It really destroyed the culture there. So they wanted to adopt Western technology, learn about, military technology without really adopting the culture initially. And so he was hired as a military advisor for one of the warlords. He taught them military engineering and marching and other things.
How interesting, right? He's the shogun.
Yes.
He's that book.
It is of the same period. Yes.
Yeah. And why did he get married?
It's hard to know. He doesn't talk too much about his wife.
Because you got to read some of his work.
Right. Yeah. Right. And certainly there were some old newspaper articles I'd found that shed some light on that. But I think he was probably lonely. There were very few, certainly very few foreign women there. And he saw an opportunity to build a business and to make the fortune that he'd wanted to.
Which he did in a matter of speaking, but he left at one point and he comes back?
Right. He creates the business. Then he decides he really wanted to be a farmer after all, and he goes back to Virginia, buys a big plantation there. That doesn't really work out that well. And so he gives it to his brother and comes back to Japan and starts from scratch again.
His family had come with him.
That's right. That's right.
I love the image of your great-grandmother making her way across the country.
That's right. With three children and not speaking any English, it must have been quite a journey.
Yeah, and considering how Asians in general were seen and treated, how were Japanese treated and seen in America in the 1880s the same as the way Chinese were treated, or were they elevated a bit? Do you know?
I think probably there was not much differentiation between Japanese and Chinese. Of course, she would have been probably, she was quite wealthy by then, so she would have been probably traveling, you know, in a good, you know, first class or whatever that entailed at
the
time. And
that wealth conveys respect.
Right, to some extent.
Yeah,
certainly.
To some extent. All right, so he comes back, they settle down. How long does he get to enjoy his life in Japan?
So he, one of the things that makes the history interesting is how history keeps interrupting, and he, World War I, of course, Germany was, unlike World War II, Germany was an enemy to the United States, to Japan, and so he was forced to leave Japan and live out the war years in Germany. So that was that would have been about halfway through the war, 1914, 1915.
How old is your grandfather by that point?
He would have been in his mid-20s.
What was he doing?
So he started working for the company. It was called Helm Brothers when he was 14 and really continued. He traveled and obviously was educated in New York and other places, but most of his life he worked for the company.
And what did Helm Brothers do by the time he was working for the company?
It was primarily a stevedoring and forwarding company. That's that was unloading ships and putting them on trucks and forwarding to warehouses and business locations.
How was he seen growing up in Japan, being a half Japanese, half Anglo?
I think it would be
right there, would it?
Yeah.
European.
Well, I think it would have been a very difficult time. On the one hand, he would have felt, he was part of the colonial system and he was obviously wealthy. So there was a sense of probably, you know, being somewhat superior. On the other hand, he would have felt the view of people of mixed race at that time was there was a lot of stigma attached to that, so he would have felt a little inferior in that sense as well. So I think he would have had a very mixed reception.
And then he married a woman who was also mixed race.
That's right. His wife Betty, her father had also come to Japan around 1870 and also started a business.
Which gets us to your father.
Yes.
I like a book that gives me the genealogy right up front, so you can just look at it.
It's pretty complicated, yes.
But it's great. So describe your father's life in Yokohama. And what are we talking now? We're talking 40s, 30s, 40s.
Right. So my father was born in 26. He grew up in Yokohama. Probably had a pretty good life. They had a summer house on the water, and but. Again, you know, we talked about being mixed race. On the surface, you did pretty well, but I think there was a sense of a lack of confidence, a lack of where home really is, because Japan really is a temporary home for most people. Most of the foreigners living there are coming in and leaving, and there's a lot of so
even though he was from there, he still felt that temporary sense.
Yeah, I think so, because you don't really have that many. There's a few families that continue to live through the different, you know, you have World War I, the Germans leave, World War II, the Americans leave. So in his case, of course, as Pearl Harbor was approaching, he had multiple, in the grandfather's case, had been warned by the U.S. Embassy many times to leave, and finally, just a few months before Pearl Harbor, did actually leave and return to the United States.
What were their citizenship papers, your grandfather and your father's?
So my grandfather just happened to be born in the United States while my great-grandfather was doing that experiment in Virginia, and so that's what made him an American citizen, even though he'd really spent very little time in the United States. But I think he sort of identified the most with the United States, and so ultimately ended up having to, you know, live out the war in California.
Yeah, yeah. All right, that brings us to you. Who wrote the book, Yokohama Yankee, Leslie Helm? Describe your life growing up.
So I had a pretty good life. I went to, it was sort of one foot in the, you know, the foreign community. I went to international schools, mostly, you know, people from all over the world. Another foot in the Japanese community. I certainly took karate and you know, spent a lot of time with I grew up, my first language was probably Japanese. I was raised by nannies. So I had this sort of dual relationship. And a lot of this book was kind of that feeling of being neither here nor there. And it kind of came to a head really when my father died. And I was at the time reporting for the Los Angeles Times in Tokyo. And I realized that he had never really felt a sense of, he'd never really been at peace with himself because he never felt at home either in Japan or in the United States. And I really began to, I was a little afraid that that same sort of thing could happen to me. So that was one issue. And then not long afterwards, my wife and I decided to adopt Japanese children. And I found myself at first excited about the idea. And then when we actually got the first picture of my daughter, I had this strange sense of resistance, which I couldn't really understand. And that's kind of what set me on the journey back into the family and trying to figure out who I was and was there really this, you know, was I racist? Was I, you know?
Well, you look in the mirror. Do you see, by this time you'd be a quarter?
Right.
Japanese and three-quarter European?
In fact, I really, in some ways, the first time I really remember thinking that or realizing that I was part Japanese was not until I was close to college. And when that realization came, I have to say I thought of, you know, yeah, I can't find shoes in the States, even in the biggest outlets, you know, whereas in any Japanese store I can find them. I there's just a lot of characteristics of Japanese within me. And
it's interesting, isn't it? You are a modern story, in a sense, are you not?
Yes, I think that around us now, it's the notion of mixed races has changed so much. It's wonderful for me to be in Seattle where there's so many people of mixed race and where people have this incredible confidence that certainly I never had growing up and actually feel pride in who they are. I mean, you look at you know, Tiger Woods and Barack Obama, and they really, you know, they talk about their heritage, and they're very proud of it.
You know, you write about your kids in this book, Yokohama Yankee, Leslie Helm, but you also write that well, first of all, yes, you adopted two Japanese children, but your wife isn't Japanese.
No, she's Caucasian.
Yeah, and so that resistance you felt when you saw your daughter's picture, did you come to define? Do you know what it was?
I think part of it was this, it sounds strange now, but over the generations, in part because of the way mixed race people were seen, I think people felt that, you know, my grandfather, certainly my father, felt they had to be more Western. They tried to hide their Japanese heritage. My father actually, you know, was beaten sometimes by his father for speaking Japanese. That was very discouraged. So I think there was a sense.
It's very interesting because your grandfather looks much more Japanese
right,
than your father did.
Right. And so I think to some extent there was a sense that was I going backwards by sort of like after all the family, after generations had been trying to get whiter and whiter, was I kind of, you know, moving? And of course, it's a ridiculous notion when you think about it, but I think that's one thing that when we define people by ethnicity, we don't realize that even if you don't look, you know, say Japanese or mixed race, you're carrying a lot of the baggage of your parents and your grandparents. And, you know, by bringing that to the surface and dealing with it, you realize it's, you know, it's not a big deal. And you can, as I did, learn to embrace that and realize that it's really a wonderful thing.
Your children had to learn to embrace it, right? And they did it at different times.
That's right. I mean, my daughter, from an early age, she was constantly asking about, you know, adoption and always wanted to talk about it. And my son to this day is a little reluctant to talk about it.
Well, he also sounds a little more, maybe he's, cavalier.
He's a scientist. He doesn't think it's relevant.
Well, he knows it's not.
Right.
In the end, he knows what the distinctions are and how small they are.
Absolutely.
Do we live in an Asian city? This city, I shouldn't even say Asian. Are we a different kind of city because we're on the West Coast and of such mixed interests than, you know, Chicago?
I think absolutely we are. I think people of Asian descent come to places like San Francisco and Seattle in part because there are others here and they feel more comfortable. Certainly there's the cuisine here is very familiar. And it was interesting to me that Bellevue is now apparently making this movie to advertise the fact that there's a lot of mixed race people and diverse population, right?
Are we a new? Do you find that we're a new sort of place compared to Yokohama, for example?
I do think. I think Yokohama still has not really embraced that. It has this international element and it has a Japanese element, and I don't think they've quite embraced that yet. And I think in a place like Seattle, just because of the dynamism of the place and the constant new immigration and also the focus on innovation and creativity, that really shifts, you know, where people are coming from and that places a value on diversity, you know, because it's about who comes up with new and great ideas, who can do something better than somebody else.
It's hard to blow up that notion of that race or ethnicity defines you. Seattle's trying to do that, but we all of us stumble back into it, I guess.
That's right.
When you did some digging, you traveled, you were looking for your great-grandparents, your great-grandmother's home village. Will you describe what happened when you found who you thought were your relatives and then found out who the relatives really were? You were at a smaller village and then a house in a smaller village, and then you saw the bigger house, and the decision was are you going to be invited in or not?
Oh, right. Well, it was an interesting story because it would have been very hard to find. We'd lost all touch with my great grandmother's family, and ultimately a reporter was willing to write a story, and I got this message from the day later from a Shinto priest who turned out to be a distant relative, and he showed me the grave, and he pointed out that the house that was closest to the grave was probably my closest relative, but that guy didn't want to have anything to do with me, and this friend, you know, basically shook the newspaper article and said, you know, you got to see him, or you know, who knows what might happen? It's going to be very embarrassing for you. So the guy finally did let me in.
Go ahead.
Yeah. And
well, how were you received? How were you received once you were sitting there? Some of them had to stay outside, right?
Right. So the relative was a priest from a very, very famous temple in Japan, but he, you know, he didn't have standing in that village. So this young guy was quite cold, actually, which is unusual, very unusual in Japan, where people are usually very hospitable. And he was like, you know, I don't believe that. I was showing him the pictures, and he said, oh, this stuff's 100 years old. How can I trust any of this, you know? And I actually had a family tree, and I said, well, you know, I sort of mentioned direct members of his family, and then he was like looking behind his palm of his hand and saying, well, anyway, you're all wrong, because Hiro, you know, was married to, never had children,
Well, that family had their own myth about what had happened to this woman rather than follow the truth that she had married a European.
Right. And partly it was myth, partly, as I discovered later, one of the members of our family, my grandfather's oldest brother, had taken Japanese citizenship because Japan required, we operated tugboats and barges, and to operate those in internal waters in Japan, you had to be a Japanese citizen. So he had taken this Japanese citizenship, and what I learned was that they had put his name in the papers as being the husband of one of his mother's sisters. I mean, it was obviously a fiction that they had just done in order to get citizenship, because in Japan you must be part of a registry in order to have citizenship.
So you went to this village, you went to some other villages, and you,
right,
like I say, there's a lot of cool pictures in there.
Right.
So you grabbed this grinding stone,
right,
from this village. You put it in your trunk of your rented car.
Right.
Where is it now?
It's under a camellia bush in the back of my house.
Why did you want this?
You know, I I felt this incredible connection to this place. It was a place was my other great grandmother, and it's way up in the wilds of Kyushu, is a city to the southwest, and I'd never seen a place like that that had been. It was virtually abandoned. Apparently, disgraced. We had heard that it was disgraced samurai that had hidden there, and they had this whole story in the sense that, you know, they had been disgraced samurai since they had lost a major battle, you know, and their clan had been sort of related to the emperor, and it was a elaborate story, but they had escaped to this particular village to avoid being decimated, and had lived there for 700 years. And this notion of them having been outsiders for 700 years really kind of struck home for me. And I thought, God, you know, we were outsiders for 140 years. You know, big deal.
So big deal. Leslie Helm was born and raised in Yokohama, Japan, where his family has lived since 1869. He worked as Tokyo correspondent for Business Week and the LA Times. It was during his years abroad that he adopted two Japanese children, began research that results in this new book, Yokohama Yankee, My Family's Five Generations as Outsiders in Japan. So you know, you end this book thinking about your father.
Right.
Who was, as you write, he was a tormented soul.
Right.
Is that fair to say?
Yes, he was.
What's your message to him? What are you telling him by writing this book?
I love him. I forgive him. I feel like he went through some difficult times, and it was a difficult period to live in. It must have been very hard for him, you know, hiding his Japanese heritage. And I realize he did the best he could. You know, he did better than his father, and I'm trying to do better than he did. And I think that's just the way that we all do the best we can.
And so that's also, I guess, the message you're giving yourself about why you wrote this book.
Yes, and I feel that it's about, ultimately, I felt when I started as an outsider, and in the course of writing this book, I found that one of the things I found is that we are all outsiders in some way in different parts of our lives. And, you know, we can learn to create our own communities. And I've certainly created a wonderful community here in Seattle. I found this city is so welcoming. And, you know, we take our past and we treasure it and we embrace it, and that adds to texture and the richness of our lives.
It's a happy ending.
Yes, it is.
Is that right?
Yes,
it's a happy ending. Leslie Helm reads from Yokohama Yankee on April 3rd, next Wednesday. That's at Town Hall. Chin Music Press put together this very cool book, and a very, very solid book as well. Leslie Helm is editor of Seattle Business Magazine. Appreciate you talking to us.
Thanks so much, Steve.
This is Weekday.
Ten 42, a little old-time radio history in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from the Center for Spiritual Living on Sandpoint Way, offering a modern way of celebrating Easter on Sunday, March 31st, 9 and 11 a.m. Services include Reverend Kathy Ann Lewis, CSL Choir, and Children's Choir. All are welcome. Details at spiritualliving.org.
52 degrees in Seattle, mostly cloudy. Forecast says chance of showers today with a high of 59. Then expect clouds overnight with a low of 45. And tomorrow, Friday, mostly sunny with a high of 62. You rely on KUOW to bring you news and information that reflect our world. And we rely on you. Listener support makes everything you hear on KUOW possible. Right now, your support will help keep our upcoming spring membership drive on target so we can get you back to regular programming sooner. Make your gift online today at kuow.org. Help give the drive a head start, and thanks. 10:44, I'm Bernard Ouellette. Recommendations for a lunch nook and a cookbook in 10 minutes on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Quiet, please. In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
This is Jack Benny talking.
Jordan, Rocky Jordan.
Have you ever danced with a murderer?
This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
King County.
And now we take you back to the golden age of radio. Because Katie Sewell and I, we are fans of old-time radio.
We are big fans. One could even say we got into the business because of it.
I can say that. For me, it was listening to the old CBS radio mysteries that were on in the 60s. After most of network radio had gone away, they brought that back later in the 60s with E.G. Marshall as the host. And so much of the web has brought us all sorts of access to these old radio shows again. Mm-hmm. You can find them anywhere.
I know. My collection of actual physical tapes is now out of date.
Yeah, you put it, it's a whole new industry, and some people, I'm sure, are upset about it, but so much more is accessible. You get to revisit what was a pretty amazing, what do we say, 30 years at the max of radio in its original incarnation through these dramas and comedies and thrillers and mysteries.
Well, it was a huge part of Hollywood and, you know, drama in New York at that time. It was the business to be in. So
that's right. Whenever you look at a Hollywood star, they always ended up also having a radio show. I mean, Lauren Bacall and Humphrey Bogart having a radio show for a year and a half that was right after they met and did The Have and Have Not, I believe.
Or they'd at least make a guest appearance. I mean, even Lucille Ball does some of her best and most serious work in radio drama.
My favorite old-time radio show that I'd never heard of until all these websites came up and taught me them.
Yours truly, Johnny Dollar.
Yeah.
It was the show that featured the harrowing adventures of an insurance investigator, which is was an interesting concept. It aired on CBS from 1949 to 1962, and it was actually the last detective-type series that actually lasted before Golden Age radio just shut down almost entirely.
That was it. It was one of the last network shows, too, right?
Mm-hmm. And one thing can be said about Johnny Dollar. That character was played by a lot of people. And as a way of looking back, I thought we could look at all the different people who played him.
Yeah.
So Dick Powell was the one that was originally going to be Johnny Dollar. All he did was cut the audition tape. And then he never went on to do it. But here, let's listen to a taste of what he sounded like.
I'm an insurance investigator. My name is Johnny Dollar, and I can pad an expense account with the best of them. My work sees to it that I really live anywhere, except at home. If you're interested in buying me Christmas presents, I take a size 42 suit. Shirts 15 and a half, collar, sleeve length 33. My hat size is 7 1/8, except when I wind up a successful case. Then it runs about 7 3/8.
Dick Powell never actually played Johnny Dollar to the public.
No, because he went on with his own production company to do Richard Diamond, and before that, Rogues Gallery, and then he went on to television.
And we'll have to talk about Richard Diamond, because that's a show that I actually hated when I first heard it, and I absolutely love it now.
So well, he was the first singing detective.
Exactly. So who it was actually played by when it went onto the air was Charles Russell. He was the first one to play him.
Expense account submitted by investigator Johnny Dollar. 2, Home Office, East Coast Underwriters, Terminal Building, Hartford, Connecticut. The following is an accounting of my expenditures in the investigation regarding the Paracorp policy for your company. Expense account item 1. Plane fare to Benton, Ohio, $40.04. Item 2, plane fare Benton back to Hartford, $40.04. Explanation, purchase 2 one-way tickets. Because of the type of case I'm usually assigned, I never press my luck by buying round trips. This time, I was almost right.
So what I love about that, besides that they're just goofy shows, he's an insurance investigator, the whole thing is hinged upon the expense account.
It's how he describes the narrative arc of what's going on, what the plane tickets cost, how much he's spending on a phone call, et cetera, et cetera.
And may I say that in comparison, plane tickets in the 40s, expensive. Cab drives, not so much. And meals, really cheap. That's what I learned from listening to this show, among other things.
Exactly. And we know how much we've lost. And when a show ends, he always signs off by signing off the expense account and signing it yours truly, Johnny Dollar. That's where the title of the show actually comes from. So as soon as Charles Russell's out, Edmund O'Brien comes in. He's the third actor to play Johnny. And here's him closing off an expense account for a show that was titled The Alonzo Chapman Matter.
Expense account item 2, miscellaneous, while in Los Angeles, $255.08. Item 3, same as item 1, transportation back to Hartford. Expense account total, $672.08. Remarks? The second murder, Max Gerber's, was a gangland rubout, planned with the aid of a young blonde as bait. The first murder was only a mistake. The apparent moral is that companies shouldn't hire salesmen. Women shouldn't marry them. Young blondes should stay away from them, but confidentially, some of my best friends are insurance salesmen. Yours truly, Johnny Dollar.
I love hearing Edmund O'Brien do it because, of course, he's had a big career in movies even by that time. He was DOA was right around the time. Whenever you listen to these old-time radio shows, when it's Edmund O'Brien, they always say, and of course you can listen to our star and
yeah,
DOA.
It was truly Johnny Dollar. So John Lund plays him briefly after that. And then we get to 1954. The show takes a hiatus. It's off the air for more than a year. And when they come back, Bob Bailey has become the star, starring as Johnny Dollar. At that point, he was well known for a radio show called Let George Do It. And the show also decided to change its format at that time just to set themselves apart from other shows. So rather than a weekly half-hour show like all the other radio dramas were, they became a serial that ran all week, doing 15 minutes every single evening. Let's hear Bob Bailey as Johnny Dollar, who is the favorite.
Johnny Dollar.
Pat Gallagher, Universal. How'd you make out with Miss Reardon?
I met her. She thinks I'm an insurance broker or something. I told her I knew her husband when he was alive.
Industrial hazard lying. Part of the business, John. Did you find out anything that'll help you?
I found out she's pretty upset about everything in the world.
That's the only report you have for Universal Adjustment Bureau?
Oh, she invited me for cocktails. I'm going to call her later this afternoon and keep the date. Maybe I'll get some information then.
Cocktails, say? You made out okay.
Oh, shut up.
So Bob Bailey, like I mentioned, is considered the most favorite Johnny Dollar of all time. And I actually like him the best, too. And he was the favorite because he changed the character a bit to make him seem a little more human. He wasn't like typical radio detective being really hard-boiled or cynical. He was smart, but he made a lot of mistakes. He got too emotionally involved with people he was on cases for. And so he has a realism about him that the other Johnnies didn't have, both in the writing and in the way that Bob Bailey played it.
You know, we're talking about this old-time radio shows, and because this one is the favorite or the best, Superman also did that 15-minute serialized version as well. But Johnny Dollar was radio's golden age, and from what we've learned, one of the last shows, I think it was, what was it, one of the thriller shows that you like was the last actual show to go off the air.
Actually, I think Johnny Dollar went off after, but Suspense lasted the longest of the mystery shows.
So Suspense and then Johnny Dollar.
Mm-hmm.
You can hear a bunch of these where I've been finding them for free, and you could look. We put a link up, archive.org. It's the Internet Archive. We did a story on those guys a while back. They are amassing all sorts of video and audio stuff, and it's really interesting.
Well, and if you like Johnny Dollar or you want to hear an actual full episode, I put a link there to it. They have like 700 different episodes and with all these different actors playing Johnny Dollar. So,
all right. I hope we talk about more of these in the weeks ahead because I've been listening to one called The Man Called X, which is like listening to Cold War politics in a nutshell.
Mm.
This is Weekday. Cold War politics in a nuclear nutshell. Very tasty nuclear nutshell. Every Thursday, Sarah Dickerman joins us because by Thursday we want to eat lunch. Maybe you prefer to cook yourself. She also has a great cookbook as well as a lunch recommendation to offer. Sarah Dickerman writes for Slate, the New York Times, other publications. She blogs at sarahdickerman.com. Sarah, what have you been eating lately?
I have been eating very well. I wanted to mention also that I worked on the Seattle Magazine's Best Restaurants issue, which is out right now.
Oh, you did?
So lots of advice there. And recently, I ate again at one of my favorite little restaurants down in Seattle, which is the Tillicum Cafe, and it's down the north end of Belltown near the Chief Seattle sculpture, which you might recognize. So it's just a lovely little place. Again, I know I mentioned last week that I'm seeing more and more breakfast extending into lunch hours, and they do some great egg dishes, including
always like good,
delicious baked beans on toast, which they serve with roasted tomatoes and a fried egg on top. yummy. That's very filling, but it's delicious. If you're looking for something a little bit on the lighter side, though, they do these lovely little savory pastries, and I had something that was like roasted beets and carrots with a little cheese in there, all wrapped up in a beautifully light, flaky crust, and they make wonderful soups. And it's also just a very pretty place, pretty windows filled with light. It's very nice pause in the day.
What's the story behind it? Is there a chef that is well known to you?
Well, I've known Cuthbert, I think I'm pronouncing her last name correctly, actually worked at one of the restaurants I have worked at in the past, not at the same time as me. She worked at Vio's as well. And she's just been doing this restaurant, I think it's 3 or 4 years old, and it's just really steady and beautiful details in the food there, and I really enjoy it every time.
How long has Bob Culbert been working here? How long has Tilquin Place been around? A while, do you think?
I think three or four years or something like that. But I don't want to be, I might be a little off.
I'll tell you. Has restauranting, can I make a word up, restauranting, evolved, changed from in the last few years in Seattle? Has it felt different to you? Smaller places with simpler menus are often what you're recommending these days, and it just makes me wonder, are we seeing an evolution?
Well,
or a trend?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, there's a massive shift in restaurant culture today across the country, which is towards simpler, more casual food, and it means less fuss going into your dinner, whether that's white tablecloths, you know, that's a linen cost you can get rid of if you don't have tablecloths at all. Louder soundtracks, a little more youthful attitude, loud music in the restaurants and stuff like that. So you are seeing that. And then, of course, it's a product of the recession. You do find, you know, really intimate little spaces opening up that might be less finished feeling for that reason, but it's also because they're driving, they're getting a lot of their business from alcohol, which is less true at lunch, but at dinner time is a big part of this new equation in restaurants today.
So does Tilikum Place Cafe feel to you, and this is my bias showing, like a restaurant that we would have found in Portland a few years ago and maybe not in Seattle, but now we are seeing these types of places in Seattle?
I don't know. I mean, there's certainly Portland has set the tone for a lot of Seattle restaurants. I actually think Tilikum is nicely finished, though. It's a little bit less rock and roll to me than, say, a Portland restaurant can feel. It does have a nice bar culture. They have good cocktails at night. But it's actually kind of airy and a little bit grown up. So I like it. I like it for that feeling.
I like to think of myself as airy. I don't know about grown up. All right, Deborah Madison's book, Vegetable Literacy, is a cookbook you've been looking at.
Yes, and everyone needs a little reminder as the markets start opening about just what to do with all those vegetables you see in the market. Deborah Madison is the classic vegetable cooking authority in the country. She wrote this book called Vegetarian Cooking for Everyone, which people love, and she has a new book out that is, again, a guide to different varieties of interesting vegetables, gorgeous photos to get you out there and shopping at the market and then cooking.
Have you cooked anything from it yet?
Yes, I have. I just made some lentils, which she, you know, I'm a huge lentil fan, but I tried her technique where you make a kind of walnut pesto almost with walnuts and herbs and a little bit of garlic and a little bit of cream, and you toss that all with the hot lentils, and then the garlic blooms on the hot lentils. It's very fragrant, and it was a great way to eat lentils.
Sounds great. Vegetable Literacy, Cooking and Gardening with 12 Families from the Edible Plant Kingdom with over 300 deliciously simple recipes. And you can also get some deliciousness at Tilikum Place Cafe. Sarah Dickerman has been one of the folks who you worked with a few other people here putting out the Seattle Magazine's Best Restaurants 2013. Oh, Allison Austin Chef was one of the other people that wrote this. And you can find that in Seattle Magazine. Sarah, it's good to talk to you. We'll talk again.
Always good to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you. Sarah Dickerman also writes for Slate. Weekdays produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, Andy Hurst, Amin Al-Sadeh, Danielle Anthony Goodwin, and Bernard Ouellette. Have at it, sir. Have a good day.
Thank you, Steve. It's 10:59. The number of Americans seeking unemployment benefits was up last week. That and more of the day's news in a minute. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from United Way of King County's Hunger Action Week, committed to raising awareness of the struggle to keep enough healthy food on the table. More information on solutions and volunteer opportunities at unitedwayofkingcounty.org.
53 degrees in Seattle. Forecast says we're going to hit a high today of 59 with clouds and a chance of showers. When you need help with food, medicine, mental health, addictions, adoption, foster parenting, or child support, the state agency in charge of helping you is the Department of Social and Health Services. That department has a new leader, Kevin Quigley. We're going to talk with him later today. Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.